The journey to today's presentation began on July 25th, 1998. On that date, I joined three other LK co-workers, and on Saturday morning, we drove to downtown Chicago to attend the last session of the 1998 Conference for Business Women in Chicago. It was a glorious Saturday. It was a lot like the weather's been recently here today. The sun was shining and the temperature was balmy, and it was a picture-perfect day on Michigan Avenue. So when we arrived downtown, we made a pact, and we said, tell you what, we're going to all meet at lunchtime, and we're going to decide how we're going to spend the afternoon. We're going to decide whether we're going to spend it in a hotel conference room or stroll in the sunshine on downtown Chicago. Well, we met at noon, and the decision was unanimous because the speaker that day was really dynamite. That morning, we'd learned some valuable tips about managing conflict and confrontation, diffusing explosive situations, and disarming disagreeable people. And all signs were that the afternoon session would be too good to miss. So we decided to stay, and we made the right choice. The speaker at that day-long session is here with us this afternoon. Mary Robinson Reynolds is an educational psychologist. She's a family and child counselor. She's an author, a consultant, a motivational speaker. She has a master's degree in educational psychology, counseling, and development. She's an educator with over 20 years of experience, and her programs have assisted business people, educators, and at-risk children. Her book is called You Are a Success, and it includes 61 proven strategies to achieve success. What she does is stimulate the reader to think at a higher level and to be innovative and creative. Mary has personally delivered her message and her program to over 20,000 business people in the last several years. Her list of clients includes familiar names such as Hewlett-Packard, Sprint, Merrill Lynch, Boeing, McDonald's, United Airlines, even the United Postal Service, and the dreaded Internal Revenue Service. Her personal motto is, excellence is not a goal, excellence is a standard. Mary brings a gutsy approach to the issues of communication, change, and success. It is my pleasure to introduce Mary Robinson Reynolds, who's going to talk to us this afternoon about masterminding for success.
Thank you. What I'm going to take you through now is a foundational piece on how the mind works so that you understand what you're coming together and how you come together with other minds. But we first must understand our own mind. And so I'd like you to go back to page one on your workbook, and I'm going to walk you through a foundational piece so you understand the masterminding process. And I will explain the masterminding process, the methodology, and then we're actually going to do a mastermind experience so that you will get to see what this is about and how you can best utilize it within your teams, your organizations, and even within the Kaizen process or the event. I think it marries well into all that you are doing. So let's talk about the mind. There are five pillars that I depend upon and that I use throughout change, throughout communication, throughout any form of adversity that comes my way. I will march myself through these five pillars. And the very first pillar has to do with making a decision. What I find also in our culture and our world is that we have not been taught to make decisions. There's nothing like the power of the made-up mind, and there's nothing like the power of your made-up mind when you make it up. But we've been taught not to decide. What are some of the reasons that we've been taught not to decide in this society? Why have we been taught not to decide? What are some things? Don't decide.
Fear of accountability.
What else?
Things
could change, and then I'd be what?
Wrong. SOL.
SOL. See you later. Controversy. We're afraid to make a decision because it might cause controversy. Somebody may disagree. What else?
Punishment.
Who said that? Okay, notice who said that. No, just mark that. No. Punishment, fear of humiliation, fear of annihilation, fear of embarrassment, fear of shame. In this society, I would say that it really hasn't been very well received to make an error. Would you all agree? No, there's a great fear of that, isn't there? As Pat Riley, when he was the coach of the New York Knicks, that was a while back, but he said this. He said, there is no failure, there's only results. And what we must learn to look at as that there is no failure. We have to look at decisions as just making them. And we haven't done that. One of the reasons we haven't done this has to do with our formal training, which has to do with how we were brought up. There was some research conducted back some years back that you and I have all experienced, and that is from birth to age 5, you and I were taught, we were told no 40,000 times. From birth to age 5, 40,000 times. You and I, we were all told no. Now, do children need to be told no? Absolutely. But what we're not backed up with is a yes. And we were told yes only 5,000 times. That's a huge imbalance. And so what has happened to our decision-making ability is that we don't trust ourselves. We don't trust our ability to decide, and we don't trust the world to receive our decisions well. And so what we do is we go into a place of indecision. The problem with indecision is that it is a decision. And it's a decision not to decide. And from that place, we become actual greater victims. The possibility of victimization is even greater because we're not deciding. Now, when I make a decision, it doesn't mean that your decision doesn't matter. It just means that I'm making a decision to be in my power and to be in my mind and to know what I know, feel what I feel, and what I want. We come together in relationship when we start working that out. But we help no one. We make no forward advancement when we can't even decide for ourselves. So the greatest thing you can do as leaders in this company is to make a deliberate daily event of deciding. I make a daily event every day. And first 15 minutes of every day, I spend deciding. Deciding how I want my day to go. Deciding who I want in my day, deciding what needs to be done, and I write all that out. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But the first step, the first pillar, and I'd like you to write it down on the line, is to decide. Make a commitment to decisions. Decide, 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 decide again. Because what happens as you start learning to do this, you start getting in touch with what's important. And you must decide as if there were no impossibilities in the world. You must learn to decide as if there were no impossibilities, as if everything were impossible. Deciding does not hinge on the how. A lot of us won't decide because we don't know how. We don't believe it's possible. You must decide regardless of whether you think it's impossible or not. Decision is just a mental act, but it taps you into your mind power. It is the very first act that must happen. And here's what I decide. It's very simple. I decide how I like it to be. That's it. In a nutshell, write that down, how you'd like it to be. Now, I don't know how I'm going to make it happen. That's a different how. All I'm concerned with when I'm deciding is how I would like it to be. If I could have it any way I wanted it, how would that be? If I couldn't fail, what would that be? If money weren't an object, time weren't an object, if there was no limitation, how would I like that to be? See, you and I have not languaged at this level on a daily basis. We don't. We haven't been taught this. This is the number one cause of conflict in communication, is that we're not saying truth. We're not speaking. We're not saying how we'd like it to be. We're doing a dance. And the more we dance, the less we get accomplished. The less we get accomplished. I'll repeat that. The more we do the dance, the less we get accomplished. Because we're not saying it. We're too busy worrying about what other people are going to think or what they're going to say. Back. And when you really know who you are, and when you really know what this is about, and what you want and how you'd like it to be, you have a new language, and you immediately take your thinking and communication to a higher level. Immediately, instantaneously. Most of us have been taught to think in how we, and speak in what we don't want, what we don't want, what we don't want. We spend 99.9% of our time there. To really move forward, we have to become disciplined about deciding and thinking in terms of how we'd like it to be. Now, to do that means we have to take a risk. And there are three risks. Now, I want to see who's a risk taker in here. Now, I thought about doing a tandem. I thought, nah, I got to get back home. All right, who'd like to give me $2 for this $5 bill? Well, who'd like to give me $2 for this $5 bill? Like right now. Like right now, who would like to take the risk of running up here and giving me $2 for this $5 bill? Who would like to act on that? All right. Thank you very much. Let's give him a big hand. It's Mike. Congratulations. Mike Tucker. Mr. Risk Taker. Now, what were you all thinking while I was doing that?
What's the catch?
Oh, they're going, 3, 5. Why didn't she bring a 10? What held most, you know, I had a few people reaching. I had like 3 or 4 people. But the rest of you are just sitting there. Now, what was that about? What? I only had a one. You only had a one. Well, you have the only legitimate excuse except for you could have tried to talk me out of my vibe with a one. That would have been a risk, wouldn't it? Uh-huh. So what do we do when we're faced with a risk? Well, you sit there. What else do we do internally?
Evaluate.
We evaluate. So you're evaluating. You're trying to figure out what I'm doing, right? So instead of coming up and making some money, you were busy evaluating what I was doing and where I was going to go with this, right? How many of you are thinking, what's she going to do with this? How many of you were thinking, well, does she mean come up there and get the dollar? How many of you were thinking about that? Do I have to come up there and get it? Nobody thought that? That's what I would have thought. Do I have to walk up there? What do I have to do? But notice each of your processes. That's how you take risks. So I guess we could all grow in this area, huh? Would you all agree? Well, there's 3 steps to risk-taking. There's 3 elements to risk-taking that we need to understand. And the first one is that we must move into an intellectual risk. And I consider this probably the most painless of all of the risks because it's intellectual. No, we're not going anywhere. We're not going to take an action. We're just going to take an action right here. An intellectual risk means that I'm going to cause myself to get out of my habitual thinking. I'm going to show you how to do that right now. The mind is a creative mechanism, and its only desire is to create. It has incredible creative capacity. And you utilize this capacity all the time without thinking about it. But now I want you to think about it, and I want you to get very deliberate about it. The mind has the ability to create far beyond what most of us even have a chance to use in this lifetime. I believe there's some research that says basically the mind power that we're using we're not using 90% of it. So that means we're maybe using about 10% of our mind power, what our minds are capable of. And so the mind also has what is known as a reticular activating system. Now, this is a very important system. How many of you have heard of this system in the mind? Well, it's a very necessary component to how we think because it helps us focus in. The reticular activating system polices out anything unlike what we're focused on. So if I'm focused on the problem, I cannot, the reticular activating system will not allow me to see anything but the problem. Now, you've all been there. I know you all have. Let's look back a little bit. How many of you remember when you decided to start families and bringing the first kids along? How many remember back? Okay, and so maybe you announced, your wife announced that we're pregnant, and now your focus goes in on family. What do you see at all the malls and the supermarket now? Or out at the parks? Kids! All everywhere. So your focus of attention is now shifted and it's on family. Or let's use cars. How many of you bought a car recently or remember when you last bought a car? And you drove it off the lot, right? And then what did you see on the freeway? 1,000 cars, just like you. Now there's about a gazillion out there. What happened? Were there more cars like yours manufactured in the last 24 hours, or what happened? What happened, really?
Awareness.
Your awareness, your attention to it, and so then it policed out anything unlike that. Like, I never see any car that I once drove anymore. I don't see those cars anywhere. I don't even remember the names of them. But the point is that it polices out. Now, we're faced with a problem in the organization. And what we have been taught to do is to focus in on the problem. And in that, though, we police out solutions. So the problem is over here, solutions is over here. There's about this many solutions, there's about this many problems, okay? And so what we do is our mind can't see it. And that's called habitual thinking. Now, there's another word for habitual thinking. It's also called precognitive commitments, and we've all made them. One of the authors that I've studied over the years is Dr. Deepak Chopra. And he is a renowned endocrinologist, and he's done a lot of vast research in the area of the mind, the body, and the spirit. And what he says about our thinking is this. You and I will think 80 to 90% of our thoughts that we think today, we will think again tomorrow. And 80 to 90% of our thoughts that we think tomorrow, we will think again the next day. So this is called habitual thinking. It's also called a precognitive commitment. He's done some really interesting, he recognized some research that's been done over the years. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of this so you see how a precognitive commitment is formed. You know about elephants over in India. And because they're huge, strong animals, that they start training them when they're very little. And so what they do with the baby elephant is they'll put a heavy chain around one of its legs, and then they'll tie it to a boulder. Well, that elephant has the perimeters around that object that it's tied to. And it begins to make this commitment to that area so that it is a contained, it becomes contained in its mind. As the baby elephant grows older and older, becomes a large elephant, they may not even need a chain or even a flimsy rope, so that elephant feels the tug. But that's all it takes. And the only thing that can move an elephant out of this would be extreme abuse. And we've all seen what happens with elephants that have been extremely abused. They bolt out. But and you and I tend to do that too. We'll wait until something's so awful that we'll bolt out of our precognitive commitments to things that we thought could only be one way. But for the most part, we would all agree most elephants are able, they're able to control. That's called a precognitive commitment. They've done some other research that I found very interesting. They had some fish and they put them into a fish tank, of course. And it was a huge fish tank, and they divided the fish tank in half with a glass partition. And they left him with the glass partition for some time period. And so the fish could swim up to the glass partition, but they never could pass because the partition was there. They took the partition out. The fish from the right-hand side never crossed over to the left-hand side and vice versa. They would go right up to where that partition was, but they would never go past. So even in an animal that small, there is a precognitive commitment to space and to orientation that neurologically takes place in the minds. Then they did some other research at the Harvard Medical School with some kittens. And they took a group of kittens, and they had two rooms. In one room, they had everything painted or drawn in vertical stripes. And in another room, they took some other kittens, and they had everything in horizontal. Everything was either horizontal or vertical. And they raised the kittens until they became grown-up cats, and then they brought them out of these rooms. And the cats were running into furniture legs. I mean, they just were so disoriented. They couldn't function in the real world. Not because the chair or the couch weren't real, but because neurologically the connectors and the things that the electrons that need to fire weren't happening. There was no way to connect because there had been no pathway built. And so sometimes when I'm faced with a problem, I ask myself, am I in a vertical world or am I in a horizontal world? What's my commitment here? What is it that I think has to happen? What is it that I think cannot happen? Because that just means I've made a commitment to that reality. That doesn't mean it is real. It doesn't mean it has to be the reality. It means that that's what I've accepted. And that's I need to create a new pathway. I believe there was one other research that I guess the kittens was the last one. So what we want to look at is how to interrupt that. And because we need to be able to do that individually if we're going to be powerful in a mastermind type setting where we bring other people and other people bring us up to higher levels of thinking. But we must start with ourselves first. So how many of you have ever lost your car keys? Mm-hmm. And where'd you find them? Where you left them, that's right. That's right. So let's say that they're on the kitchen counter right here, and you have an airplane to catch, and you're running a little bit late, and you run into the kitchen, and you're going, I've got to get going, where's my car keys, and you're standing right here, and they're right, how many of you had this happen? They're like right in front of you. And so what happens is that, first of all, you're upset. Right? Now you're getting more and more agitated. And what happens when we get upset is that oxygen does not get to the brain. And without oxygen to the brain, we really don't think very well because we need the blood, we need all of that in order to have our minds really function well. So what happens is you stress out and finally you cannot see them. So the reticular activating system literally will not let you see the car keys because what are you saying? I can't find my car keys. You say that enough times, that's your intention, that's your statement, your mind hears that, and it will police out your ability to see what's right in front of you. And that's the whole thing that we are dealing with in our corporate environments and some of our personal relationships, is that we can't see another solution because we're in the problem, the problem, the problem. So you go to the airport, you catch a cab, and you get home about a week later because you finally give up, and you walk in the kitchen, there they are, you go, there's my car keys. First thing most people do is blame the kids. Johnny? You'd be like, no, it wasn't Johnny, it was you. And it's what we're saying. It's our language. Rudyard Kipling said, the most powerful drug known to mankind is words. What we say is a drug to us because it will drug our ability to think. And so every time we say, it's impossible, I can't, we're policing out the solution. We police out the solution. We're not discerning about what we're told in the society. Let me ask you this. How many of you know about how we got 8 glasses of water as a daily drinking requirement? How many of you know the original story? Where this all began? Well, I got this from my doctor, so it must be true, right? Well, it's a woman doctor, so it really must be true, right? I'm not putting down doctors here. I'm just saying, look at how we make decisions, how we accept truth based on authority, status, whatnot. So here's the story, and I do believe it's a true story because as I tell it across the United States, more than one person has heard it, so that must be true. Back in the 50s, when we first started getting the black and white televisions in our homes, you remember that, they started doing a variety of programming, and one of the programs that they started trying out was interview programs. And they had a renowned doctor on one day, and the interviewer said, now, doctor, what kind of food should we eat to have a well-balanced diet? And the doctor basically went through the food groups, yada, yada, yada. And then, I'm sorry, I wasn't going to do that anymore. That was from some television show. And then the interviewer said, and doctor, how many glasses of water should we drink a day? And the doctor scratched his chin, and he thought a moment, and he said, well, I like 8. I like 8? And so you and I have been trying to drink 8 glasses of water for the last 30 years. Whether we need, how many of you can do that? Drink. How many of you are doing that? And how many of you are beating yourselves up saying, I should drink more water? Well, isn't that a terrible waste of mind energy? So, I mean, think about it. We do this. Well, I shouldn't eat eggs. How many of you did not eat eggs for the last 20 years? Okay, and now they're okay, sir. They're okay now. You can have. You see what? We wait to see what people say. Yet, if we ask ourselves, how would I like it to be? What do I really want right now? Is it a glass of water or not? The answers that we're seeking are that simple. So I went out about a year ago. I ran across a book and I bought it. It was a $20 book. It's by a nutritionalist. And she says this about water. She says, if you're thirsty, drink. If you're not, don't. I know, doesn't that make sense? Yet I spent $20 on that book. That's what I was crying about. But we don't ask ourselves. You see, mind power comes from asking ourselves. It comes from inside. It comes from what we know, what we feel, what we want. We've been taught not to want. Because why? What might happen? If you did decide, if you did, could have, what might happen? You might what?
Might be wrong.
Might be right, might be wrong. Might be wrong. You may not want what you thought you wanted. And then what would you do? But we've also been taught not to want because I think it's Mick Jagger who says you can't always have what you want. We've been taught that if we really want or really desire something or really decide upon a thing, what is something that might happen? We might get disappointed. So let me ask you this. Is there anybody in this room today who has not been disappointed by not wanting? No, so I guess it didn't work. The answers we seek, the solutions we need to create are as simple as if I'm thirsty, drink. If I'm not, don't. That's how simple it is, and yet we've made it so complex. And so the intellectual risk is to pop ourselves out of habitual thinking. And this is what I do. In the face of adversity, in the face of an impossible situation, doesn't matter what, as soon as I call it impossible, as soon as I hear myself say, this is pointless, it's impossible, I know I'm in the problem. And so I merely ask myself this, to pop myself, because I want to wake myself up, because I'm just in a vertical world or a horizontal world. I'm not necessarily in reality. I think I am, but I'm not. And I want you to write this down. Does this have to be so? This is going to interrupt your thinking. What we want to do is interrupt. Does this have to be so? Now what that does to the mind is it starts stimulating it. Stimulating new pathways. We want to create new pathways, new neurological pathways. Does this have to be so? Now, I am not anywhere near a solution yet, but I am waking up. All right? Now I'm about right here. And now I'm going to open this door. Intellectual risk also means getting new knowledge. So the way to pop yourself out is to now go seek knowledge. You're awake now. You got to do something with yourself. And one of the things that you do physically, and that's the next risk, is take a physical risk. Sometimes it's just changing your physiology. The risk is to, like if you're with a group of people and they're all saying it's impossible, oh, woe is me, and you get caught into that energy field, maybe the physical risk for you is to pop yourself out of that group and get out of there. That would be a physical risk, wouldn't it? Because somebody might think what? Something. Somebody might think something. But you have to pull yourself out of that. Part of the biggest piece of work I do is pulling myself out of where I've been. Because the answers are going to be the same. There's no solutions in where we've been. There's only new solutions to where we haven't gone yet. And this is how you get there. So the first step is to ask yourself, does this have to be so? The next step is to physically alter something. Now, some people like to exercise, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you go exercise. It just means physically do something different. Maybe a physical risk for you would to stay in the face of adversity. Maybe the physical risk for you, and when there's conflict and confrontation, is to not go the other way. Maybe it would be to stay put, to stay in your body, to listen through what's going on. Many of us in this audience either stonewall or we put our heads in the sand or we get our dukes up. All of that has not worked. And so in this place, we start initiating new physical change. For me, being a redhead with a little bit of a temper behind that, my dukes come up pretty fast. But for me, a physical risk is to put those down and to step back. So for a person like me, it's to step back. For other people, like people who like to avoid, well, it's not that you like to avoid, it's that it's just a way to get out of here. It's to stay put. It's to sit on yourself and make yourself listen through what's going on and stay present for it. You don't have to say anything yet, but you need to be able to stay in the face of the scariest stuff that's in front of you. That takes guts, that takes courage, that takes where maybe you haven't been before. But whatever that risk is for you, you initiate it at this point because what it's going to do is going to stimulate your thinking because you haven't been here. And so you're going to start creating new pathways. And the third risk is the emotional risk that now comes into play. And the emotional risk is this. How do you want it to be? You haven't articulated it yet. You haven't really thought about it. When you ask yourself, how would I want it to be? You go right into your gut and your heart. You go into your feelings. And the reason why we go there is because we haven't spent a lot of time there. And when you start talking to people about how they want things to be, you will see an immediate change, an immediate instantaneous change in people because it moves them from here to here. And we need both to mastermind. We need both to be in our power. Your heart and your gut tell you a lot of stuff. They tell you truth. They tell you what you want. They tell you if it's right. Back to decision making. You know, you've all made decisions that you knew weren't right, haven't you? How many of you consider yourself intuitive? Well, let me ask you this. See, how many times this week alone have you said to yourself, I knew I shouldn't do that? Okay, you're all intuitive. How many of you got children? And it gets quiet in the other room? What do you know? Yeah, see, we're all intuitive. We all are. We all are, and we all feel it a couple places. One is right here, one is our heart, and sometimes we get, ahead. But for the most part, I think most of us get, if it's a no, it's right here.